A BYD está com ofertas para você levar um elétrico ou híbrido novinho para a sua garagem. Vá a uma concessionária e faça um test drive. BYD, construa seus sonhos.
Boa noite, muito bem-vindos. Uma visita de honra no Conversa. Esta noite a gente recebe um grande jornalista americano. Ele, na profissão, chegou ao topo da carreira, foi executivo de grandes empresas de comunicação, editor da revista Time, CEO da CNN, até que ele decidiu trocar o poder e seu exercício pelo saber e seu compartilhar. Lançou-se no mercado editorial com um livraço atrás do outro e acabou virando o maior exemplo no mundo de biógrafo de qualidade e sucesso, muito sucesso. Mais que estratégia comercial, o projeto dele descreve o arco de uma aventura intelectual. Ele biografou Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, personagens que têm em comum, além da genialidade, sensibilidade artística, aliada à prática da curiosidade científica. Ele acaba de lançar um novo livro, no Brasil chama-se A Decodificadora, que conta a história de Jennifer Doudna. Ela foi uma das ganhadoras do Prêmio Nobel de Química do ano passado pela revolução que vem promovendo na área da genética. Então a nossa conversa hoje é com Walter Isaacson.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Delighted to be with you in our show. May I call you Walter?
Yes, please, Walter.
It's not an easy task, but you're used to it. Would you explain in a few words what is CRISPR and why Dr. Doudna has deserved a Nobel Prize in chemistry for that work?
CRISPR is a system bacteria have been using for a billion years in order to fight off viruses. They take a mugshot of the genetic code of a virus and then cut it up if it ever returns. What Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier and their team did is in 2012, they figured out how to re-engineer this old system from bacteria to edit our own DNA. In other words, to be able to cut genes and replace genes in our human body. And so it's a simple, easy to program gene editing tool.
It's amazing. We already knew quite a lot about human genome, but we didn't quite know or dare to edit it, interfere with it. That's the case, right?
Right. We've always known since maybe 1900 how we have genes that we pass on to our children and their children. And in the year 2000, we pretty much were able to map the human genes. But now what Jennifer Doudna and her team have been able to do is say we can do more than just read our genes. We can rewrite our genes. We can do things like cure genetic diseases such as sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis. Or we could even edit our children to make them taller or more muscular, to have a certain hair color.
Let's hear Dr. Doudna herself explain how she puts it.
And so we imagined a system working very much like in this video, where the Cas9 protein could be directed to enter the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell, and with its guide RNA, search the genome for a 20 base pair sequence that would match the 20 nucleotides, the 20 letters of the guide RNA that would provide a match. And when that match occurs, we now understand that Cas9 is able to unwind the DNA. It allows the Cas9 protein to generate a precise double-stranded break in the DNA by cleaving each strand of DNA. And then those broken ends are handed off to repair enzymes in eukaryotic cells that lead to DNA repair. And in the process of repairing the DNA, there is the ability to introduce a change to the genome at a precise place, which is really the definition of genome engineering.
So are we already there? We can use CRISPR to deprogram diseases in our genetic code? This is present or near future?
This has already happened. This past year in Mississippi, here in the United States, a woman with sickle cell anemia, which is a simple genetic disease, they used CRISPR and she became cured. She's now producing healthy blood cells. They did it in Germany with another genetic blood disease. They've done it in Oregon, curing blindness. They've used it in China already to help fight cancer. And so these are the things that have already been done. Also, 2 years ago, a Chinese scientist, in an experiment that was pretty much unauthorized, did it in early stage embryos of what became twin girls. And he edited out the receptor for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. And by doing it in an early stage embryo, he crossed a line that people weren't quite ready to cross, because that means the edit is inheritable. It means not only will the two girls have that edit, but all of their children and all of their descendants will have that edit. These are things that have already happened. We're not talking about something in the future.
What about the impact of this work in the research for a COVID vaccine?
What Jennifer Doudna discovered early on in her career was how RNA works. We all know about DNA. That's the famous molecule that carries our genetic sequences. But RNA does the work. It does two things. It can be a guide so that you can use a scissors to cut up DNA, and that's what the gene editing tool is. But it can also be a messenger that tells our cells which proteins to build. And in the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, these use messenger RNA, and it tells our cells to build a little fragment of the spike protein from the coronavirus. And that means when the real coronavirus hits, we have an immunity to it. So all of this stems from the great work on this little known molecule called RNA.
And what is being spoken about is that this will be applied to cancer fighting as well. It could finally be a breakthrough in treating cancer via RNA messenger as well.
Right. The RNA messenger can produce both proteins and ways that our immune system can fight the cancer. Also, CRISPR can be used because cancer is pretty clever. And it can turn off our immune system when we're using an immunotherapy to fight cancer. But with CRISPR, we can make it so that the cancer cells can't turn off our immune system, our immunotherapy cells.
As you mentioned some moments ago, there is a fine line that's about to be crossed or not to be crossed. The Chinese case you mentioned was kind of a scare. And it has always been like this throughout history when scientific breakthroughs happen. But even Jennifer herself, I think it was in a story you wrote to Washington Post, if I'm not mistaken, she had a nightmare. A real nightmare. And she dreamt of Adolf Hitler with a face of a pig and congratulating her for her discoveries and work. What about you? Do you dream about it? What are your nightmares?
Well, I have a couple of things I worry about when it comes to CRISPR. One is that if it's all up to individuals and you can just buy better genes for your children, the rich will be able to buy better genes for their kids. They'll be able to make, you know, this is a few decades from now, they'll be able to make their kids taller or maybe have better memory or more muscle mass. And we already have a society in which there's a great inequality. But this would kick it up a notch. This would make it so that the inequalities in our society are encoded into our genes, encoded into our species. And it'll be like the book Brave New World or the movie Gattaca, in which there's a genetic elite and then an underclass. Secondly, I worry about editing out the diversity of our species. If we leave it up to individuals, you know, we will make sure that people may not be deaf or may not be, you know, fat or whatever, but we kind of like the diversity of our species. Having said that, Let me make clear that for the next decade or two, we're not talking about nightmares. We're talking about dreams here. We're talking about the dream of being able to cure cancer, the dream of being able to get rid of these horrible genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis or muscular dystrophy. I get emails every day, people showing me pictures of their grandchild or their son or their granddaughter saying, you know, she or he has this genetic disease. Can you put me in touch with Jennifer Doudna? Because I don't want him to die. I don't want her to die. So let's celebrate the dream of what CRISPR can do, even as we look down the road and try to guard against the nightmare that could happen if we're not careful.
It brings so much hope. That's the fact. You've written biographies of great men in the history of science and technology, males. Jennifer Doudna is the first great woman, female. Is this milieu finally getting less prejudiced against women?
I think that women have been written out of the history of science and technology, and also women have not had as many opportunities. In one of my books, I wrote about Ada Lovelace, who was the person who did the first computer algorithm in the 1840s. When Jennifer Doudna was in school, her dad left on her bed a book called The Double Helix. And when she read it, it was about the structure of DNA and James Watson and Francis Crick discovering it. But when she read it, she noticed a character named Rosalind Franklin. And young Jennifer said, wow, I didn't know that girls could become scientists. And her school counselor said, no, girls don't do science. But Jennifer persisted, and she did. So I think it's important that we have role models to say, yes, women can do science. Women can go into biotechnology. And nowadays, you know, more than half the people studying biology are women. So I think we're beginning to overcome that prejudice that used to exist against women scientists.
And it was damaging for all of us, actually. The last 100 years, as you show, saw three technological revolutions: the atom, the bit, and the genes. You've written books on Einstein, Jobs, and Doudna. Are you carefully following a plan?
You know, I didn't know it was a plan until I got to the third of the string. I'd like to say, hey, I was really smart and I knew this. But after I wrote about the physics revolution of the first half of the 20th century that gave us the atom bomb and space travel and semiconductors and lasers, I said, okay, I'm going to do the digital revolution next and do it through Steve Jobs. And that gives us the computer, the microchip, the internet. And then I realized that we were entering a new century in which the big innovation would be in the life sciences, that we'd be able to edit our own genes. We'd be able to make messenger RNA vaccines that would cure us of diseases. And I realized this was going to be even more consequential than the revolution that gave us the iPhone and the computer. And so I said, okay, how am I going to do that revolution? And I met Jennifer Doudna, who is such a wonderful character, so smart, so interesting. And she had figured out the structures of some RNAs that show how life began on this planet. And then she figures out the gene editing tool. And then she turns her attention to fighting COVID. And she turns her attention to dealing with these ethical issues and trying to get an international consensus on it. So she became a perfect central character for me to take on the life sciences revolution.
Da Vinci, Einstein, Jobs, all of them had not only scientific minds, but also artistic sensibilities. Is Jennifer Doudna also kind of an artist?
Yeah, she studied the humanities as well as the sciences. Her father was a professor of literature and, you know, of English and novels and literature. And like Leonardo da Vinci or Steve Jobs or Benjamin Franklin, she liked to stand at the intersection of the humanities and the sciences. And that's why she's an important central character in telling this tale, because she not only cares about the science of gene editing, she cares about connecting it to our human values, connecting it to our lives and our society, and thinking about what this will mean, not just scientifically, but to the human race and to humanity.
So this is what is next for us, for the progress of humanity, the intersection, the interlace of science and humanities.
You know, if you're, take Brazil, a country I love. And whenever I go there, it's a creative country. It loves the arts. It loves music. It has a great sense of design, a great crew of artists. It also is at the forefront of things like medicine and science. Places like Brazil, or maybe my hometown here of New Orleans, in which there's creativity and the arts and the humanities, and it's connected to engineering and to science and to technology. That's what Steve Jobs used to say, which is if you can stand at that intersection of the arts and technology, that's where creativity will occur.
Jobs died just a few weeks before your book was out. And being the man he was, do you think he would have approved of your book, of everything, or what would be his complaints?
He told me he wanted me to write it, warts and all. And as you know, he was a very rough character, but a charismatic one, a brilliant, a genius who drove people mad, drove them nuts, but also drove them to do things they never knew they'd be able to do. When I was spending that summer of 2011 at, you know, with him and interviewing him, I read him the last chapter of my book. I told him and read him portions of the book that I thought he might not like, such as when people criticized him for being too rough on people. And I quote him in the book where he says, yes, that's a valid criticism, but we wouldn't have been able to have a team of A players at Apple if I hadn't been that way. I didn't want to be one of these velvet glove leaders. So he knew what I was going to write in the book, and I really respect him because he said, I'm not trying to influence it. It should be your book so that it feels like you're giving your whole picture of me rather than some book that I get to decide what goes into it or not.
One of his colleagues, Steve Wozniak, in the film adaptation of the book, calls him in a sequence an asshole and says, you can be gifted and decent at the same time. In your experience as a biographer of geniuses, is that right? Does that matter?
Yes. I mean, there's no one formula for genius. And after I wrote my Steve Jobs book, I'd get people who ran companies and they'd come up to me and they'd say, I'm just like Steve Jobs. And I would laugh, you know, give me a break. But I'd say, why? And they'd say, because when somebody's doing something that's not good, I just tell them that what they're doing stinks. They're horrible. They're messing up. You know, I'm like Steve Jobs. And I say, wait a minute. Have you ever invented the iPhone? Have you ever invented something like the Macintosh? Not everybody gets to be a jerk, or as you put it, you know, an asshole that way. And Steve Jobs, even though he was that way, was able to inspire people. And you quote Wozniak saying that if Wozniak had run Apple, we would have been nicer to everybody. We would have done it like a gentle family. But then in my book, Wozniak says, but maybe if I had run Apple that way, we never would have put out the Macintosh. So you have to understand a person as a whole person. By the way, Jennifer Doudna, the hero of this current book I've written, she's as nice as can be. She's very collegial. And I talk about how she forms teams, and it's different from the way Steve Jobs does. Steve Jobs liked having creative tension. He'd find people who would clash with each other and would sort of spark new ideas. But Jennifer Doudna, when she forms a team, she says, I want everybody to meet the new member of the team and see if we can all fit in, because she wanted people to work together and be friendly and collegial. Well, there's no right way. The way Steve Jobs did it worked for him, and the way Jennifer Doudna did it, it won a Nobel Prize. It worked for her. So people should not read biographies like mine and say they're a how-to book, how to form a team, how to be a jerk, how to be whatever. People do it differently. Look inside yourself and say, what is my best way of being a leader?
The first book of yours that I read and I was charmed by was about Da Vinci, Leonardo. And he was kind of a decent genius, if you can use this expression, Wozniak's expression, but he was also a procrastinator. Is this a trait shared by other geniuses as well?
Well, as I say, there are a few traits that are shared by all geniuses, like curiosity, or this ability, as we said, to stand at the intersections of the arts and the sciences. And as you said, Leonardo was very, very nice, had a group around him, and you know, they were all friendly. That was different from Steve Jobs. And by the way, it was different from Michelangelo, who was alive in Florence at around the same time. So there's not one formula. Now, when it comes to procrastinating, you know, when Leonardo was doing the Last Supper, he just spent days and then he'd do one brushstroke. And the Duke of Milan is saying, get on with it, get on with it. You're not working hard enough. And Leonardo would say, sometimes when you're not working, you're actually thinking and you're formulating things. And that's how intuition comes. Now, there's an upside and a downside. We only have about 12 finished paintings from Leonardo. If he had worked harder, he may have put out many more paintings, but he also may not have done The Last Supper or the Mona Lisa.
Is the project of adapting the book to cinema still on? Is Leonardo, his namesake DiCaprio, is going to be him?
Yeah, they're still working on the movie. I'm not sure who's going to be in it. You know, I understand even some physics, having written about Einstein. I understand editing our genes, having written about Jennifer Doudna. There's one thing I don't understand, and that's Hollywood. I can't figure out what they do and how they do it.
Your daughter once said, each of your biographies represents a side of yourself. Do you agree?
Yes. She was poking fun of me, and she said, all right, you wrote about Benjamin Franklin because you were writing about yourself. You know, he was a writer, a journalist who becomes a diplomat and becomes interested in science. And then I said, well, what was I doing when I wrote about Einstein? She said, well, you're writing about your dad, which is true, who's sort of a kindly engineer with a wild halo of hair who loves the humanities and electrical engineering. And then I said, okay, what about Steve Jobs? And she said, I'm not sure. I said, I think I was writing about a bratty kid who loved technology. And so maybe I was writing about you. But now I tell my wife, Kathy, who's wonderful, that when I was doing Jennifer Doudna, I was writing about a persistent, smart, nice person. And so I was writing about my wife. And that's gotten me a lot of credit in recent weeks.
That was a good move. What about Henry Kissinger? What about Henry Kissinger?
When I asked my daughter about that, she said, oh, Dad, that's when you were writing about your dark side.
You've been the editor of Time Magazine, CEO in CNN, and then you once said you don't like being a boss. So doing journalism is better than ordering it to be done.
You know, we all have to learn what we're good at. And I was, you know, you've been in this position. I have. You're a journalist. You love what you're reporting. You love what you're doing and producing. And then they say, well, you become, you know, good at that. So we're going to make you an editor. And then we're going to make you a CEO of a division. And instead of reporting stories, you're dealing with a whole lot of, let me say it, between us, you know, people with outsized egos, you know, who are in journalism or whatever. And you realize you've become a manager. And after a while, I said, I don't like being a manager. I'd rather go back to writing and reporting and playing with ideas myself. And so after a while, after I ran CNN, which was is a great network, I just thought, all right, I wasn't cut out to be an executive managing thousands of people.
It's reportedly when you're young, you were approached by the CIA to become a spy. And declined, I think. What are the differences and maybe the similarities between spies and reporters?
That's a good question. You've done your research. I'd half forgotten about that. I'd studied in England, and I think there was a CIA station chief there. I didn't even know he was CIA. I thought he was just like a political attaché. But one day he recruited me. And no, I didn't do it. I took a different job. But I do think reporting and trying to dig out facts is based on both a curiosity and a sense of mission. You say, okay, I want to inform people. I felt much more comfortable doing it as a journalist because I wasn't beholden to anybody else. I could just say, now this is the old days before, nowadays a lot of journalists have their own ideologies and they're trying to advocate certain things. But when I became a journalist, I did it out of curiosity. I cared about foreign policy. I cared about science. I cared about technology and American politics. And so I was driven by curiosity. I think sometimes as a spy, you have to do a lot of deceiving of people, I guess. I've never been one. And I think as a rule in journalism, rule number one is never deceive anybody. Always be transparent. So I think I felt more comfortable on that side of the line.
You mentioned the present-day journalism with a cause. And this is one of the symptoms of what happened to journalism and has been happening with the digital revolution. What in 2012, 9 years ago, you came to Brazil. You were at the center of the stage of that TV show, Roda Viva. And you said, remember that. You said then that Brazil looked comfortable with the free flow of information. Well, a lot has changed. And today we are the worst case of pandemic management in the world. Bad information has a lot to do with it. So seeing from the outside, any clue about what might have gone wrong?
Yes, I don't want to comment too much on politics, but I think leadership matters. And as I said, being transparent and being honest is something we really need from our leaders as well. And I think we've had it in the United States with Donald Trump. You've seen it in Europe and you've seen it in Brazil, a different type of leadership that's more authoritarian, that doesn't respect as much debate or the free flow of information. And I think whether it's the future of politics or the future of innovation, the future of science, it comes from that basic free flow of information and freedoms. And especially when you're fighting a pandemic, you want great scientific work. You want people to try to follow the science and follow experts. I think we've had this revolt, this populist revolt, this authoritarian revolt that sometimes attacks experts or attacks common sense and the middle ground. So from my own perspective, and I say I try not to be too much of an advocate, but I believe in the freedom. I believe in free speech and free thought. I believe in democracy, where we each get to choose our leaders. And I'm hoping the world will turn back to that. I think many things caused it, including social media and the internet, which was able to spread disinformation. But I can't wait to get down to Brazil again, hopefully when the pandemic recedes, because I love Brazil and I'd love to find out for myself and hear from people like you answers to those questions.
We would be very happy and glad to have you back in Brazil, because it's a bitter moment we are going through here. People are very pessimistic about, well, we cannot see any future. And when hope is under threat, then it's close to be everything lost. So give us some reasons. What are the main reasons to be an optimist today?
Einstein wrote that democracy is like a gyroscope. Just when you think it's going to tip over, it knows how to right itself. And he was so pleased it happened in the United States. I don't like getting political, but I think we see it happening a bit in the United States now. Joe Biden may not be the most forceful, the most wild or charismatic leader, but we don't need a wild or charismatic leader right now. We need somebody who's calm
and trying to fix the economy and trying to fight coronavirus. And I think the United States may be correcting itself, and I hope that's a harbinger for what will happen in Brazil.
God willing. Thank you so much, Mr. Isaacson. It was a pleasure. I know it's not evening in Orleans at this time, but you mentioned Ed Murrow's, I would say good night and good luck for all of us.
Good night and good luck.
Yeah. Take good care of you. Thank you so much and for all your books and work.
Hey, let me say what a pleasure it was to be interviewed by you. You have a wonderful charm. You also have read the books, and your questions were great. I wish we could do this all the time.
Thank you so much. I hope we have another opportunity. I'm really flattered by your acknowledgement. Thank you very much.
Well, God willing, and in person. Stay healthy, please.
Yes, I'm taking care of it. Tchau, gente. Até a próxima. Quer ver mais? Entre no Globoplay. Até lá.